Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We forget. We used to live in real terror of the nuclear warheads that lurked in silos, submarines, and the bellies of Russian and American long-distance bombers. But today, we get the sweats over North Korea's nukes, loose nukes, and Al-Qaeda suicide bombers in the Moscow subway. And so, when President Obama and Russia's President Medvedev struck a deal Friday to reduce their nuclear arsenals by 30%, you had to ask, have they just made the world safer, and from whom? This hour On Point, a new step in nuclear arms control and what it means for the world. You can join the conversation. Does the new U.S.-Russia treaty sound like a relic of the past? How do you look at the old arsenals? They're still there. And what do you fear more? Mistakes or nuclear moves by the Pentagon and Politburo? Or by Pakistan, Iran, North Korea, Tora Bora? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Moscow is Clifford Levy, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times. Clifford Levy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We have to ask first about the aftermath of the subway bombing there, 39 dead and 60-plus wounded, as I understand. Is Moscow still, ringing with those blasts?
Well, I think people are pretty shell-shocked. There hadn't been terrorist attacks here in the city center in Moscow itself in about 6 years. There had been a sense that the Kremlin and the Russian government had isolated or contained the problem of Muslim extremism in the area of southern Russia in the Caucasus Mountain regions. It hadn't reached here into the population centers in several years. Well, yesterday was evidence that it had come back, and people are very frightened. There's a lot of anxiety here, and there were a lot fewer people on the subways in the morning rush hour today than clearly there were there is on a normal day.
Now, there was the bomb that hit the train to St. Petersburg not so long ago, and here, right in the heart of Moscow, what kind of response is anticipated, and what does it mean for Moscow politics, for Russian security?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's what we're all wondering now. I think people in the Russian government are very frustrated. This is a problem, this issue of Islamic extremism. And I should caution that we don't know yet who the perpetrators are. We don't know yet who organizes. But the assumption here, the Russian government's suspicion, is that it's Islamic extremists who are from the Caucasus Mountain regions. If that's the case, it really represents a continuing problem that Russia has had since the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. The Russian government has fought to suppress two brutal civil wars there, and despite their successes, their occasional successes, they've still been unable to really clamp down on it.
You say Islamic extremism, and maybe so, but the people there may say, "Well, we're extreme because Russia has set on us so hard."
Yeah, well, you know, the issue is extremely complicated and contorted and complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Islamic extremism. It's intense government corruption down there. It's poverty. It's one of the poorest regions of Russia. It's also issues like clan politics, which are very powerful in those areas. So it's hard to really identify one cause of this. One interesting debate that's gone on now is the slightly different attitudes toward this problem being taken by the Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin,
mm-hmm.
who is still considered Russia's paramount leader, and President Medvedev, who is Mr. Putin's protege and has believes in taking a somewhat softer or less tough stance
mm-hmm.
On the terrorists, in the sense that he's talked about going after the root causes of the problem. He said that he gave a speech in June where he talked about how we can't just attack the terrorist leaders, we also have to address corruption and poverty and government malfeasance. That's not something that Putin has really discussed.
Does this weaken Putin because his reputation was built on stopping this kind of attack, or does it strengthen him in the pushback?
That's the real question today, how the public is going to react to this, how whether he will lose support because people will say, well, you had claimed you were protecting us, and now look, this happens in the center of Moscow, or will it strengthen his hand? There are some political analysts who say that earlier terrorist attacks in 2002, 2003, 2004 did not weaken Putin, if anything, straightened him. strengthened him. Now the question is how he's going to handle this these current attacks and whether or not it will hurt his standing.
Clifford Leiby, let's turn, if we may, to the nuclear arms treaty agreed. Still has to be ratified in Washington and Moscow, but agreed last week by President Obama and President Medvedev. This is a follow-on to the 1991 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. That expired in December, so there's been, I guess, no framework around two countries who have still enormous arsenals. Give us a sense of the nuclear arsenal of Russia at this point, Clifford.
Well, they're enormous on both sides, and this treaty did expire at the end of December. There had been an informal agreement between the two sides to essentially act as if the treaty was continuing, and these negotiations had been ongoing in Geneva, and they finally, there had been a little bit of gamesmanship, and they finally reached a point last week where they were able to kind of handshake it, at least verbally handshake it. The language is not completely drafted yet, but there's expected to be a signing of the treaty between Presidents Obama and Medvedev in Prague in April.
This would mean an actual reduction in the number of deployed missiles on land, sea, and air.
That's right, roughly 30%. And it's particularly important for President Obama because he sees it as the first step in his vision of a nuclear-free world. Clearly, we're a long way off from that, but it's a vision that at least rhetorically, the Kremlin has signed on to.
President Obama has put this in terms of helping in the effort to keep other countries from building or expanding nuclear arsenals, not least Iran. Does it look as though it may play an important part in that effort?
Well, the Russians have sort of, in some sense, tried to compartmentalize these two issues. The Russians are extremely ambivalent about what to do with Iran, what to do on the question of sanctions against Iran over its apparent efforts to pursue a nuclear program. They lately have suggested more and more that they may sign on to some sort of sanctions, but they have a real problem, which is that they have their own relationship with the Iranians. A lot of people probably don't realize this, but Iran and Russia are practically neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
They almost share a border, and in Soviet times, the Soviet Union did share a border with Iran, and I think that's creating a lot of ambivalence in the Kremlin. They really don't want to alienate the Iranians, and this almost sort of comes back to our earlier discussion about the subway bombing. One of these issues is that Iran exerts some influence in the Caucasus Mountain region, where Chechnya is and where these Islamic extremists are. And I think the Kremlin fears that if it alienates Iran, Iran could then stir up trouble in the Caucasus.
Everything woven together today, even as this agreement comes to light and awaits both action by the Duma in Moscow and the U.S. Senate in the United States. Clifford Leiby in Moscow with the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Here's President Obama on Friday going before the cameras to announce that he and Russia's president had just that day clinched a deal on the New START treaty. But he says the deal between the two countries really is only the start of a broader global effort here.
With this agreement, the United States and Russia, the two largest nuclear powers in the world, also send a clear signal that we intend to lead by upholding our own commitments under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. We strengthen our global efforts to stop the spread of these weapons and to ensure that other nations meet their own responsibilities.
President Obama on Friday. We'll be joined in a moment by Dmitry Trenyan, an analyst in Moscow. But first, I'm joined in the studio by a big voice in the community of nuclear proliferation experts. Graham Allison is director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration and special advisor to the Secretary of Defense under President Ronald Reagan. He's the author of Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. Graham Allison, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
What's most important about this handshake agreement between the two leaders on Friday?
Well, I think there are two or three things to say. First, as President Obama said, this is a significant evidence of leadership by the U.S. and Russia as the two nuclear superpowers, that they are fulfilling their responsibilities under the Nonproliferation Treaty and therefore have some authority or credibility in pressing other states to fulfill their obligations. And that's relevant in the case of Iran, as you already suggested, but it's relevant in the case of Pakistan and others. And I think there in particular, the president was concerned that we're rolling into an agenda right now which 2 weeks from today will see 44 heads of state meeting in Washington for the first ever nuclear security summit, which is focused on loose nukes and locking down all weapons and materials to a gold standard. And then a couple of weeks later, the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference starts, which is another place where there needs to be some momentum.
At the UN.
At the UN, and which is the review that occurs every 5 years of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is really the centerpiece of what holds back other states from getting nuclear weapons.
Does this deal give Washington, Moscow, moral authority that's significant in pushing their agendas in those meetings?
Well, that's an extremely good question. And I would say for somebody like Kim Jong-il or the supreme leader in Iran, I don't think that they're going to be, I've got it. Okay, you guys did such a good job by cutting by a third that I'm going to change my view.
I mean, the U.S. And Russia, I read, still have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. Cut that by a third, and you've still got an overwhelming hand.
Still have a huge number. And so if you were imagining their psychology or their perspective, I think the likely impact is limited. On the other hand, for the other states who are crucial in pressing them to do things that need to be done, the U.S. and Russia playing a credible role in minimizing the number and role of nuclear weapons in international affairs is evidence of their fulfilling their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore I think makes more likely that Obama will have a credible argument with people who come together in Washington 2 weeks from now. Look, all nuclear weapons, all nuclear materials to a gold standard now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new step in U.S.-Russia nuclear arms control and its implications for the world and for loose nukes. Graham Allison is with me from Harvard's Kennedy School. We'll be joined in just a moment by Dmitry Trenyan in Moscow. At a press briefing on Friday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates was quick to reassure those who need reassuring that fewer American nuclear weapons doesn't mean no nuclear weapons.
America's nuclear arsenal remains an important pillar of the U.S. defense posture, both to deter potential adversaries and to reassure more than two dozen allies and partners who rely on our nuclear umbrella for their security. But it is clear that we can accomplish these goals with fewer nuclear weapons. The reductions in this treaty will not affect the strength of our nuclear triad, nor does this treaty limit plans to protect the United States and our allies by improving and deploying missile defense systems.
Graham Allison with me in the studio. If you'd be good enough, give us just a quick sort of snapshot of these two countries and their nuclear arsenals. Secretary Gates talked about the nuclear triad language, again, out of, we remember it well, but nukes on land and sea and air, I presume he still means.
Well, it's hard to remember, and it is a bit of deja vu. So at the height of the Cold War in 1968, the U.S. and Russia had 70,000 nuclear weapons. I mean, grotesque beyond belief. At the end of the Cold War in 1991, those had been reduced to about 55,000. Today, 19 years later, there's about 21,000. And this is a reduction of another third. So one's going down in a fairly significant way. That is, if you'd said at the end of the Cold War that there would have been a 60% reduction in the number of nukes within 20 years, you'd say, well, that's pretty good. So there's a high level of dismantlement. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, as Secretary Gates said, for the foreseeable future, nuclear weapons continue to play an important part of the U.S. defense posture for both deterrence for against all possibilities, but then also for reassurance of other states like Japan, which, if the U.S. weren't providing that reassurance, might acquire nuclear weapons of their own. So I think the end game of this story gets pretty complicated.
So we can just picture it. They're still out there. They are in the silos, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, in submarines armed with nuclear weapons, in ready and long-distance bombers.
Yes.
In both nations still.
Yes. Yes, and both nations, now the mix between the U.S. and Russia differs slightly. So the U.S. has more warheads on submarines, which are regarded as less vulnerable. Mm-hmm. The Russians have more on land-based missiles, many of which are mobile, which makes mm-hmm. them less vulnerable. But both U.S. and Russians, hard it is to believe that here at the end of the, you know, the Cold War being over for 20 years, but in any case, there are people that go to work every day and think about the question, if, God forbid, something should happen mm-hmm. and we should be under attack, how do we respond, and including how do we respond by using nuclear weapons?
So, a big percentage drop, but with the logic of this Cold War standoff pretty much entirely gone, those arsenals remain nevertheless. What about the
thing that's called MAD, the Mutual Assured yes. Destruction.
You hit us, we'll hit you. You destroy us, we'll destroy you.
If you destroy me, I'll destroy you. Mm-hmm. That condition continues to remain a fact today and in the arms control agreement that's been reached.
What about the non-proliferation treaty? President Obama referred to it. What are these countries' formal obligations under that treaty as far as the future of nuclear weapons goes?
Well, the non-proliferation treaty, again, we're doing history, but 1968 was signed. People say, well, how did it work? Today, 184 countries, that is almost everybody, has signed the non-proliferation treaty in which they forswear nuclear weapons. So 184
entirely,
countries 100%. Have said we're having zero nuclear mm-hmm. weapons, and that includes 40 countries that could have nuclear weapons tomorrow if they wanted to.
Like
so Japan could build nuclear weapons, Germany could build, mm-hmm. Sweden could build nuclear weapons. So, in fact, this is the centerpiece which holds back what would otherwise be a flood, because if, mm-hmm. if nuclear weapons are good for you, why aren't they good for me? Mm-hmm. So the Non-Proliferation Treaty embodies first the proposition that countries will not have nuclear weapons, then the nuclear weapons states, which are the other members, the U.S. and Russia, agreed that they would reduce their nuclear arsenals towards zero. Now, that's sometimes gone slowly. Sometimes it actually went in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. But they've made a commitment in the Non-Proliferation Treaty to negotiate towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. And then President Obama has taken that a further step by embracing this notion of the vision of a world actually free of nuclear weapons, but describing how one gets from the about 1,500 warheads deployed in the current treaty that we're now mm-hmm. talking about to numbers like 1,000 and then 500 and then 100 and then zero, that story gets a little murky.
Not to mention keeping track of all the loose nuclear material potentially out there in the meantime. Graham Allison with me in the studio. Please stand by. I want to turn to Moscow. And Dmitry Trenyan, director of the Moscow Center of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He served in the Soviet and Russian Armed Forces, 72 to 93, was, among other things, a member to the delegation to the U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms talks in Geneva from 85 to 91. Dmitry Trenyan, it's very good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
How is the significance of this agreement seen in Moscow? How would you describe the Russian view of what this new agreement, waiting to be fully endorsed, but what it means?
Well, it means that the reset is a real thing, that the administration in Washington and the Kremlin have found a chance to not only work together, but to deliver the first result of a new phase in U.S.-Russian relations. I think it's seen as a testimony that the relationship is changing, improving. I think it's seen more in symbolic terms than in terms of slashing numbers.
Though the numbers cut is there, we're told Presidents Obama and Medvedev were on the telephone a lot before this handshake was reached, and that at some point along the way, the U.S. press ran with the story that President Obama had become quite angry. What were the sticking points? What made this so tricky, Dmitry?
Well, basically, Tom, Russia and the United States are a very different set of partners than the Soviet Union and the United States. The Soviet Union saw itself as America's equal in military terms and nuclear terms. In the present circumstances, Russia is a weaker party in so many respects, including a military, including nuclear. People here appreciate that Russian numbers would have to go down, treaty or no treaty. So in strategic terms, in the long term, the treaty places more constraints on the U.S. than it does on Russia. On the other hand, there was a feeling in Moscow that because the eyes of the world at the NPT Review Conference will be primarily on President Obama, he, for tactical reasons, needed the treaty at this time more than President Medvedev. And I think that the Russians used a traditional negotiating tactic, trying to squeeze the U.S. a little bit to get more to get more concessions, if you like, or get more response to their own concerns. And basically, they have two concerns. One deals with the different stages in which U.S. and Russian strategic forces find themselves at this point. The United States is placing emphasis on missile defenses, whereas the Russians are placing emphasis on offenses. And the constraints which the treaty imposes on both parties, in fact, in reality, tend to constrain the Russians more than the Americans. For example, the Russians are testing missiles with nuclear that are capable to carry nuclear warheads, whereas the U.S. is not. The Russians are producing new missiles, whereas the U.S. is not at this point. So the Russians were very insistent that they are placed in an equal position with the United States. And they managed to gain something from that, but they knew where to stop. So I think that it was a game that they had been playing from the beginning, I would say legitimate negotiating tactic, but they knew where to stop.
Dmitry Trenyan, please stand by in Moscow. Graham Allison here in the studio. We've got a lot of listeners with questions. I want to get to some of them. New York, Plattsburgh, New York. Howard, you're on the air, Howard.
Yes, hi, thank you. You may have partially answered my question. What I'm wondering about is how different classes of nuclear weapons would be treated. Would it be treated equally across the board? You know, a particular reference, I'm wondering about the neutron bomb. I'm not even sure it exists, but if it does exist, is that on a par with other nuclear weapons for reduction?
Let us pick it up, Howard. Graham Allison, what goes into this 30% reduction? Are they throwing out just the old stuff that's falling apart anyway, or what's in, what's out, what's affected, what's not?
Well, first on the neutron bomb, that's not something that was deployed by either side. So just to the listener's question, that's another category. That was a discussion and a debate back in the Carter administration and ultimately was aside.
But was this the bomb that would take out people or life but not structures?
That was the caricatured version, yes.
Yes, all right.
Save the buildings.
But
the with respect to the numbers here, the 30% reduction approximately in warheads will come from each side can decide which whether they want to take down, more of the missiles or more submarines or more from the aircraft. And so it'll be mix and match. And yes, indeed, they'll retire the things that they regard as less useful because the people who are managing the arsenals are still thinking this is a crucial part of the defense and deterrence for their own purposes. And so they want them to work as well as possible. And as Dmitry said, there are many asymmetries here. But one of the most interesting asymmetries is that the Russians are continuing to develop new missiles that will carry warheads, whereas the U.S. has been out of that business for some time.
Dmitry, do you see in this agreement a net reduction in lethality, in destructive capacity, or just in missile numbers?
Well, I think it's a question that has precious little relevance in today's world. I think that in the past, U.S.-Russian comparisons almost in all issues made a lot of sense politically or simply in terms of propaganda advantages. So in the old days, we used to talk about the megatonnage, the combined destructive power of the nuclear arsenals. Today, I think people in the U.S. And in Russia look at the nuclear arsenals as very much a relic of the past, something that gives a kind of a deterrence comfort to the Russian leadership that Russia can continue to function as a country that enjoys strategic independence, independence from the U.S. in the first place. But people are not thinking at all these days about the destructive power. One weapon is enough, basically. One missile that carries a nuclear warhead to a major city is more than enough. It's just impossible to continue to think in terms of a nuclear exchange as we used to.
Fair point. Here's a web comment from one of our listeners. Todd says, reduce nukes by one-third, so what? When it comes to murder or suicide, does it really matter whether the gun is loaded with two bullets or six? The remaining two-thirds on either side are still more than enough nukes to annihilate the entire world. Let's go to Mark in Columbia, South Carolina. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was wondering, to the extent both Russia and the United States maintain such a strong and potent nuclear force, is the real driver behind the reduction treaty an economic one and a desire to eliminate the cost of maintenance in times of economic difficulties?
It's an interesting question. Graham Allison, how about it? I mean, these are still very big arsenals. Is there a cost factor here? What does it cost these countries?
I think the cost factor is minimum in the American story, but is more important in the Russian story.
How so?
As Dmitry said, the Russian arsenal and all of Russian military forces have been declining significantly, largely as a function of economics. So if I remember the last numbers, the Russian defense budget is now about $65 or $70 billion. Well, that's about 10% of the American defense budget. So one's in sort of total disproportion.
Then our budget's just so gigantic that even a very significant expense can seem small within that huge budget.
Within the context. So a billion here and a billion there in the context of a $670 billion defense budget is not a driver for the U.S.
Let's go to Bob in Rutland, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, I was going to say, I just wanted to ask your panelists briefly, do they anticipate under this new START treaty a reduction in the number of tests, nuclear tests conducted? I know over the last few years, 8 to 10 years, the U.S. has conducted a number of what they call mini nuclear tests. So I just wanted to ask that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Graham, I'll come to you, Dmitry, but Graham, testing in the U.S.?
Initially, the question seemed to me to be going in the wrong direction. His mini test point is right. The U.S. and Russia have both been observing the guidelines of what would, if it were in treaty terms passed, be the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which sets a very, very low level above which you cannot test nuclear weapons, and neither the U.S. nor Russia has crossed that threshold.
Okay.
Beneath that threshold, it's possible to do experiments, is how it would be described by the nuclear weapons labs, that test whether this little piece of things are working or that little piece of things are working.
But smaller than weapons level.
Smaller than weapons level, though they provide information about how a weapon might work.
But now there's talk, just this last weekend I was reading a piece saying, you know, there's a debate over whether the U.S. needs to upgrade its aging nuclear weapons, which would require testing or not?
Well, that's, again, one of the great debates, so your finger's right on the right point. So there are a group of people in the U.S. who argue that the U.S. needs what they call a reliable replacement warhead. I think this is a great advertising slogan, but in any case, they think we need a new nuclear weapon, a new nuclear design with new nuclear warheads, and they say that this will not require a test, though some of the people involved in it believe that this will be actually a mechanism for a test. In the U.S. case, because there's so much effort that goes in the nuclear weapons labs into simulating all of the elements of a nuclear weapon, most of the scientific community believes that U.S. current designs are highly reliable. I think that's also the belief in Russia as well, though Russians might have even more reason for concern about their arsenal, and Dmitry might have a view about that.
We'll go to Moscow and Dmitry Trinian there again in a moment. Graham Allison, please stand by. Then there's the question of whether if you're trying to cut down, why are you revamping? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new step in U.S.-Russia nuclear arms control. and its implications for the world and for loose nukes. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're joined from Moscow by Dmitry Chenyan. He's director of the Moscow Center of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And with me in the studio, Graham Allison. He's at the Harvard's Kennedy School at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs there. Served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration, special advisor to the Secretary of Defense under President Ronald Reagan. Here's White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett on ABC's This Week on Sunday. She told host Jake Tapper that the new arms treaty with Russia is an important new card in the U.S. hand when it comes to reining in Iran's nuclear ambitions.
What I can tell you is what the president has said consistently, which is that we're going to continue to put pressure on Iran. The fact that the president and Russia are now about to sign the START Treaty is a good sign that we're making cooperation and good progress with countries such as Russia. We're going to have a coalition that will really put pressure on Iran and try to stop them from doing what they're trying to do.
Valerie Jarrett on Sunday. Dmitry Chenyan, let me put that notion to you. Do you see Moscow preparing to join in tough sanctions on Iran? The Obama administration is putting high hopes on that.
Well, I think that Russia has been using harsher language with regard to Iran, and I think that Russia is moving to join with others in agreeing on a new package of sanctions against Iran. The issue for Moscow is what's the overall strategy? The sanctions are unlikely to produce the – just sanctions alone are unlikely to produce the result that we're looking for. If Iran or any country the size of Iran with the ambitions of the Iranian leadership, with the technological capacity and financial resources of a country of that caliber decides at the beginning of the 21st century to go nuclear, it probably will. The only thing that can actually safely stop that country from having nuclear weapons will be foreign occupation, which is not on the cards. So I think that the question the Russians are asking is, what's the right strategy? I don't think they have an answer. I don't think anyone does.
We've got a Facebook comment here that's related, and I'll come to you, Graham. This is from Kate. She says, any reduction of nuclear arms is a good thing. But while the U.S. and Russia cut the number of warheads, countries like, Kate cites, China, North Korea, and Iran will make them, so the total number worldwide is still the same. She says, I don't fear the Russians using nuclear weapons. However, I do fear, she says, Iran, North Korea, China will one day use them. I mean, everybody's got the targets that they're afraid of. But what about proliferation overall? Which way are we headed, Graham? More nukes, more nuclear capacity, or less on the weapons front? And what about Iran and this step, how it may affect Iran's future? Dmitry seems to suggest that the Russian view is Iranian nukes are inevitable.
Well, I think you've come to the heart of the matter, and this is one where the optimists and the pessimists differ. And I'm sort of on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays optimistic and other days pessimistic. I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs in January that asked the question, could the global nuclear order be as fragile as the financial order was 2 years ago when people told us it was sound, stable, and resilient? And the answer is yes.
What does meltdown mean in this order?
What does meltdown mean? And you could imagine, I can imagine, and I try to go through the scenario here, we're on a path in which if everything continues on course, there'll be many more nuclear weapon states, many more nuclear weapons, and some of those weapons will find their way into the hands of people like Osama bin Laden.
Let's start with the states. People, we're talking about Iran. Who else in the many more category?
We have North Korea. We have Pakistan, which is expanding its arsenal. We have India, which is expanding its arsenal. We have China, which is expanding its arsenal. And if North Korea becomes a nuclear weapon state, you're going to see Japan scratching its head and South Korea. And if Iran succeeds in getting nuclear weapons, you're going to see a cascade in the region. It'll start with Saudi Arabia. You've got Egyptians looking around. You've got Turks looking around. So we could live in a world in which you have a cascade of proliferation. The likelihood of some of these states using weapons against each other, Israel's not going to live in the middle of many states getting nuclear weapons, or you're not going to imagine a Middle East as as riven as it is today without some of these weapons being used and some of them coming loose and some of them getting in the hands of terrorists. So I would say down that path looks like a disaster.
It makes this Moscow-Washington agreement look like a parlor game, well, if that's where we're going, unless this is a way to change the course.
Unless this is part of the strategy. And I think President Obama has argued, and I believe persuasively, that we've got to try to bend these trend lines that are going in such a catastrophic direction. And this is one little part of it, not the end of the story, but one part in which the U.S. and Russia showing that they're actually fulfilling their obligations and reducing their arms may be in a better position, both at this nuclear security summit coming up in 2 weeks, where he's going to be pressing specific states to be sure that all the weapons and all the materials in their territory are secured to a gold standard or eliminated. For example, I was in Turkey 2 weeks ago talking about this with the chief of their general staff. They had highly enriched uranium in Turkey until last December. All that material has now been removed and eliminated, and there's zero nuclear weapons usable material in Turkey.
Sounds
in
good.
In part in preparation for this meeting that's going to occur in a couple of weeks.
So that's the kind of pressure.
That's the kind of pressure. Similarly, at the Nonproliferation Review Conference, which will occur in May, the objective will be to try to get all the states to tighten the constraints on states that prevent them from actually getting into a position to make nuclear weapons, as Iran is doing. So Iran, for example, is not fulfilling its obligations. It's
right.
It's technical under something called the Additional Protocol. The hope would be to use this meeting to get other states like Turkey and Egypt and others to press Iran to say, you've got to live up to these constraints just like we do.
So it's creating an environment, whether or not that's effective enough. Let's take on a tough case. Ann Arbor, Vipul, I think, wants to suggest one. Vipul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
My question is, so U.S. and Russia are cutting down their nuclear weapons, but how do you convince countries like Pakistan, India, Israel to do so, or Iran, which is aspiring to, because Pakistan in particular is much more volatile and unstable in terms of both democracy and terrorism. And on the top of that, they have a history of nuclear proliferation, if anybody remembers A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistani nuclear bomb.
Let us pick it up, Vipul, and I thank you for your call. Dmitry Trenyan in Moscow, I hope you can hear that well from Ann Arbor, Michigan, but it's a straightforward question. I mean, the U.S. and Russia have a track record now. They have history of coming to these agreements and following up on them. How does the international community get other countries, Vipul names Pakistan, India, Israel, to actually cut down on their nuclear arsenals, not grow them?
Well, actually, Pakistan has been regarded for a very long time as perhaps the most serious proliferation risk and now a nuclear threat by the Russian strategic community. Way before Iran. And even now, I think that the Russians believe that the dangers associated with Pakistan, nuclear Pakistan, are greater than the dangers associated with Iran. There's less certainty in the Russian mind that Pakistan will actually consolidate as a state, and there's a threat that there may be a political meltdown in Pakistan, which will lead to the meltdown of the Pakistani nuclear weapons, so to speak. So it's a very big threat. India, on the other hand, is generally regarded as a quote-unquote legitimate nuclear weapons state. It's seen as a great power, a country that quote-unquote deserves to have nuclear weapons. It's also a stable country, and it is a democracy with, again, from the Russian perspective, the one great power, which is totally unproblematic for Russia. Now, I think that the Russian strategic mind is pretty discriminating. People used to be very worried, well, not very, but somewhat worried during the Cold War over the Israeli nuclear arsenal as a factor in the Middle East geopolitics. Today, no one really mentions that. No one really sees the Iranian nuclear arsenal as as a problem. Moreover, it is seen as a factor of stability in that part of the world. Again, the North Korean nuclear weapons or North Korean nuclear program is seen as essentially a political tool in the hands of an extortionist regime that is using its nuclear capability both to protect itself and to get some goodies by squeezing the outside world with a threat of nuclear or missile programs in North Korea. So again, if you, of course, people understand and appreciate the importance of the NPT treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but at the same time, they attach different values and different degrees of concern to the various nuclear weapon states or nuclear aspirants.
Graham Allison, how do you see this? Vipul says, how can we actually reduce beyond these two, U.S. and Russia? You described the kind of super proliferation nightmare scenario. What about going in the other way? And Dmitry's point, you know, he talks about legitimate weapons states that deserve nuclear weapons. Are we into classes here, two classes, three classes? I mean, who deserves and who doesn't? Or is that purely a strategic question? If you're a great power, you have more to lose, so you're less likely to use? Or how do you see it?
Well, you've got the whole cluster of it's a conundrum here. I think the idea of my nuclear weapons are okay and yours are not is easier for me to believe than it is for you to believe. So lots of the cynicism about the Non-Proliferation Treaty is the proposition that this is a permanent have and have not arrangement. But I think your hardest question that Vipul puts is how does the actions of U.S. and Russia impact the dynamics in a place like Pakistan? And I would say the impact there is limited.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of what the current AFPAC strategy of the Obama administration is about is trying to create a strategic relationship with Pakistan that will, among other things, guard against what Dmitry rightly says, the risks of the meltdown of Pakistani political control, Pakistani control of the nuclear weapons, the Pakistani military. So it's an extremely complicated story, but this is many, many pieces working together. And in the Pakistani case in particular, the Pakistani nuclear establishment feels first deeply embarrassed about the fact that A.Q. Khan, the father of their bomb, was the first nuclear black marketeer.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they're paranoid about other people taking away their nuclear weapons, including the Americans and the Indians. So it's a very delicate exercise, but they now are very much of a mind to try to show themselves to be responsible stewards. So I think there's an opportunity there, and actually, as has been reported in the paper, the U.S. has been working under the radar with Pakistan in trying to increase the security of the nuclear weapons and the nuclear materials there.
Let's get a call from John in Nashville, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was just real curious. Was there any discussion in the negotiation for the proliferation about the locations of former Soviet Union weapons that are out there and not really been taken care of, deployed? Or not really deployed, been taken out of that area where they're easily accessible. I know that it was reported often in the previous administration and even reported on, but nothing was ever done about it.
John, thanks for the question. Graham Allison, this comes to a big concern of yours. John asked about the former Soviet republics and loose nukes. What influence does this agreement or would it have on how loose nuclear weapons materials are addressed in the former Soviet Union and beyond?
Well, I think it's not the direct subject of this treaty, but it's part of the whole context, as Dmitry said earlier, in the reset of U.S.-Russian relations. One of the unsung success stories of both the Clinton and the Bush administrations has been the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which has gone on now since 1991, and which 4,620 strategic nuclear warheads that used to be in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus were all zeroed out. So those are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And 14,000 tactical nuclear weapons that, as John was saying, were all in these other republics, all have been returned to Russia. So I would say the most remarkable fact on the nuclear front about the former Soviet Union and its nuclear weapons and materials, the most remarkable fact is here almost 19 years on, not one single nuclear warhead has been found loose. Now, that's a result of lots of hard work by Russians, lots of hard work by Americans, mm-hmm. and a lot of good fortune and grace. So I don't take that for granted, but I'd say that this issue is part of the relationship in which the U.S. and Russia show themselves to be responsible stewards of the arsenals that they have, recognizing, as you said, they still have 95% of the stuff.
Dmitry, you've just seen terrorist attacks right in the heart of Moscow. Is there a concern in Moscow about loose nuclear weapons or material and the potential one day for terrorists to secure and use them?
Well, I think there's a background concern that terrorists one day may get hold of nuclear materials enough to produce something like a dirty bomb, enough to produce a level of radiation. I think there's somewhat less concern of an actual weapon being used by the terrorists. But it's not only nuclear weapons that can get you. And I think that people are very much concerned about terrorist practices overall. And Moscow, which for 6 years had been spared terrorist attacks, is now being reawakened to this fact. And I think that when people think about terrorism, the worst nightmare, clearly, in Russia as well as elsewhere, is nuclear terrorism.
Graham Allison, are we closer or further? We've just got half a minute here from that risk.
I think the bombings in Moscow remind us that the people who did these bombings, if they had a nuclear bomb, would have a nuclear event in Moscow. So I think they remind us that this is a real present danger. What prevents this being a nuclear terrorist attack is only their absence of a nuclear weapon.
Well, that keeps our attention riveted, as do actually, once you open this up and begin to look at it, so many aspects of this nuclear question. We're grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. Dmitry Trenyan in Moscow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace there. Dmitry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Graham.
And Graham Allison, author of Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. It's always good to see you. Thank you very much for coming.
Pleasure to be with you and with Dmitry.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.